And I'm going to ask you this one, Glenn. The model number WD-40, I think WD stands for water displacement. I think it's the 40th formula that was invented for a Army contract of water displacement. You use this chemical, it displaces water, and therefore protects your electronics or your machinery, your firearm or whatever from water. I think that's what WD stands for. Is that true, Glenn? KC2QIQ, KQLIW?
Yes, it is, Dick, and it's God's gift to the marine electronics. As I said, you want to spray it on, especially connectors. I mean, the electronics inside wouldn't bother me nearly as bad as the connectors go first. I mean, you know, anytime you've got like an SO239 or forget the microphone connectors. I mean, you just want to douse the microphone connectors in WD-40 and slap it in there. And it's just about dripping and then wipe it off with a rag. But I don't know of anything that's going to stop performing or detune the radio. I mean, you can probably get it dripping in WD-40. And I don't think the radio is going to detune or anything. You'd see anything funny happen there. And, for marine electronics, it's really the only way out.
What about silicone spray? Wouldn't it be a little bit safer than using WD-40 because maybe WD-40 might conduct since TB2MAR? How are you, Glenn?
I've never used silicone spray inside radios and other things. The main reason I've used WD-40 is because it really doesn't conduct and do anything. The only thing I could think of that WD-40 where I'd be afraid of conducting is high voltage. But if you're working with a radio that's probably 100 watts and less and you're running from 12 volts on a boat or something like that, I wouldn't sweat it. I mean, even 110 volt equipment wouldn't bother me. But in other words, if you're going to try to run a linear amplifier on your boat and start spraying WD-40 in there, expect trouble. And even silicone won't help you there. KC2QIQ.
Comment. Yeah. Comment. Please give us your call letters and your name, and then proceed with your comment, sir.
Yeah, this is Tim, N2RDB. Regarding WD-40, it becomes a lot less volatile when the vehicular solvents have been allowed to evaporate. And regarding silicone, I would never use that on any electronic apparatus that had any kind of mechanical switch contact. Because, yes, it'll give some lubrication and even temporary cleaning, but eventually it gums up the contacts and you have a problem. N2RDB with K2RIW in the group.
Very fine, Tim, and thank you for that. What Craig was talking to us about earlier, when you've got sacrificial zinc, it must be in the water itself because you would be amazed how conductive water is. If you properly Google the word resistivity or conductivity of seawater, you'll get a number. And before I tell you the number, I'll tell you how you could actually really measure it. And now you'll have a little feeling for what the number means. The way you measure resistivity of a volumetric material, like a fluid, is you start off with a volume of the fluid of known dimensions. Let's say, for instance, you're going to use ohm meter as the units. You can use ohm centimeter, and it's a different number, by the way, but ohm meter is the usual universally accepted set of parameters for measuring the units for measuring resistivity. You would start off with a fish tank, I'm going to call it, a plastic fish tank that is 1 meter wide, 1 meter deep, 1 meter high. And on the left-hand side, you're going to put a sheet of metal that's 1 meter square. On the right-hand side, inside the fluid, you're going to put one square meter sheet of metal. So left side of this cube, sheet of metal, right side of sheet of metal. Everything else is a pure plastic insulator, and you fill it up with seawater. You fill up that tank with seawater right off the Long Island Sound, so to speak, or the Great South Bay, and now you put the right kind of an AC ohm meter between those two sheets of metal. It's got to be an AC ohm meter because ordinary DC ohm meter, you start building up battery action, you start coating the plates with something, so it's got to be an AC kind of an ohm meter. And you could do that by starting off with a 6.3 volt filament transformer with the right kind of a series resistance. You measure the current drop, and pretty soon you'll know how many ohms. You do that experiment. You ask the average and
repeater. Time out.
average engineer, how many ohms am I going to measure between those two sheets of metal that are a meter apart, two sheets of metal, 1 square meter of area, only one side of them is being exposed to the salt water, to the seawater, and they're 1 meter apart. The average engineer will say, I'm going to measure about 1,000 ohms. Good guess. A few of them will guess 100 ohms. The answer is 0.2 ohm. 0.2 ohm is what you will measure with ordinary seawater. Seawater has a resistivity of 0.2 ohm meter. It is so extremely conductive when you have significant area that when you take something that's the area of a human body, the area on the skin of your body, just looking at one side of it, is roughly a square meter. You put your body in seawater because seawater has poured into your basement and some valuable photographs and machinery and whatever is in your basement, and you start wading through that seawater to capture your valuable object. You do that with the lights on, so to speak, and you are at a ridiculous amount of risk. You wouldn't believe how much risk you're at. If any of that seawater in your basement touches any live 110-volt electrical socket, and maybe even a 12-volt socket, if it touches any socket, and now you're getting a distribution of voltage across a very highly conductive material, you're probably going to die of electrocution. They will find you the next day floating in the water, and they will think you drowned. Let me drop.
Is that Dick? Can I make a comment on this also? KC2QIQ?
You sure can, Glenn, as soon as I finish this couple of sentences. They'll find you the next day floating in that water, and they will think you drowned. And they'll wonder, how the heck did that happen? In reality, the current flow through that water starts making your muscles not work correctly. You no longer have the ability to walk back out of that basement. And pretty soon, that electrocution that proceeds, and pretty soon you're not breathing correctly, and pretty soon you sink in that water, and you drown. They do an investigation. They're going to find seawater in your lungs, and they're going to think you drowned. In reality, it was electrocution. And a ridiculous number of people died that way during Hurricane Sandy, going into their basement, extracting what they think was a valuable object. I don't care if what's in that basement was made out of platinum, gold, uranium, whatever. It ain't worth your life. If seawater is pouring into your basement, do not go there. The main reason why Con Ed and LIPA turned off the power in communities where water was pouring in is two or three reasons. One, to save human lives, and the other was to save their equipment. But you'd be amazed how conductive seawater is. I did an experiment where I took two large metallic bowls, made phony seawater by putting ordinary salt, table salt, lots of table salt dissolved in ordinary tap water in these two bowls, and I put an ohm meter between the two bowls, and I put my left arm in the left-hand bowl, my right arm in the right-hand bowl. Everything from my hand, wrist, and forearm up to the elbow was under that so-called salty water. And the ohm meter measurement I got scared the hell out of me. It proved to me how easy it is to be electrocuted, and that water that I had was nowhere near as conductive as real seawater. KC2QIQ, K2LIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, very good, Dick. You know, one of the things that that really pointed out how low the conductivity of salt water was during Hurricane Sandy, where I'm here in Massapequa. I'm over a mile away from the Great South Bay, but when that high tide rolled in, I had a little bit more than about 5 feet of water in my driveway, and every car you could hear in the neighborhood is once that tide rolled in. And just it came up very, very slowly up over the cars. You could hear the cars were turned off; they weren't running. And all of a sudden, the first thing you could hear was anything that became active, like the alarm started going off. Because as the seawater started filling into the cars, the resistance across the circuit boards started setting off the alarms. Next thing you know, the headlights would turn on, all kinds of crazy things. And then eventually, as the water finally went over the car, it just went boop, 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 and you heard everything die. And by the time that the tide rolled out, maybe a couple hours later, every battery in every one of the cars, and these were 12-volt batteries. This was in high voltage. Well, everything was just completely shorted out. The airbags popped. The alarms were gone. All the electronics completely shorted out and dead batteries. It's really amazing how low the impedance of salt water is. KC2QIQ, back to you, Dick.
interesting description you gave us, Glenn. And Barry, N2 Moonbounce in Far Rockaway had a somewhat similar situation where the water rose on his property, on his land. I think the water rose something like 10 feet, came smashing through his picture window, floated his refrigerator up to the ceiling, made his oil tank in the backyard float down the street. But the automobiles that were alongside of his house, his neighbor's automobile, where the water rose above the roof of the automobile, the salt water turned on the headlights, turned on the horns, and so the waves of the salt water were making the car almost float. So the car was moving back and forth in funny ways with the headlights turned on, in some cases the alarms going off, with these automobiles under salt water. Really wicked stuff. I wonder if Barry is there and wants to give us a few more words on this. N2 Moonbounce, if you happen to be there, Barry, K2RIW and the TechNet. And maybe Barry's not there right now. So, as you can tell, salt water is tough stuff. Looks like WD-40 can give you quite a bit of protection as I see it, John. I still would try to put that plastic box, if I know that I'm going to be using my electronics for a lot of hours on a boat, because buying marine-rated hardware, marine-rated radios, I'm a little bit afraid it's going to be expensive, but maybe it's false economy that I'm talking about here. Maybe the right answer is to really buy a saltwater-rated radio, so to speak. You drop your cell phone in salt water, and unless you wash it out real fast, I know you're in a lot of trouble. Was there someone else that want to make a comment? Give me a call, letters, and name. K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, the only comment I wanted to warn about boxes and things like that on boats are that one thing is that you don't have vibration inside the box. The second thing is that because the vibration will destroy the electronics. The other thing is that you always want to have whatever condensation or moisture always cleared out. So in other words, you don't want to have anything that will trap any kind of moisture inside. One of the keys to making electronics last on a boat is keeping everything dry. So the WD-40 will keep the mist and all the other stuff from rotting stuff out, but the anywhere you can keep airflow around the outside so that you don't trap or condensate any kind of water on a boat is really kind of bad news. But it's just an additional warning, KC2QIQ.
If that photographic rated container I was using as an example earlier did give me a pretty good airtight seal, and all of my wires going in there, my connectors for the microphone, push to talk switch, and the 12 volt input and coaxial cable output, of course, there's a huge difficulty there of making those watertight and yet transfer through the box. But assuming I solve that problem, what I think you're telling me, Glenn, is the next step is I ought to put a container of desiccant in there so that any other moisture that gets in there gets away to be absorbed by the desiccant material, the silica gel. Is that what you would recommend? And make sure that it's in a kind of a container where the powder doesn't get into the wrong places. KC2QIQ, think that would help? K2LIW?
It might, Dick. I'm not sure. It probably depends on the application, but just about every boat that I've ever been on where I've had electronics last any length of time, placement was everything. Just like with antennas, altitude. Electronics on a boat, it's placement. Keep it out of any kind of direction of salt spray or any area where any possible spray of salt water can get onto it. So in other words, you want to find a location on the boat that's, as I would call, high and dry for your electronics. And then the boxes aren't as critical anymore. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I would also make sure that it's mounted on a nice, soft foam pad to be mechanically isolated. If it's a motorized boat, the whole frame of your boat is going to be vibrating with that propeller in the motor. If it's a sailboat, the whole darn boat is going to be slapping against the waves. So there's a lot of mechanical stress on the boat itself. And you want your radio to be isolated from that. Shock absorber, foam, a pad underneath it, whatever. Another thing you've got to recognize is that even if you put it in this weatherproof, airtight, what you think is an airtight box, between a hot and a cold day, air is a power piston. It's hard to believe, but you go from a cold day to a hot day, that air is going to expand. It's going to create a measurable amount of air pressure differential between inside and outside. No matter how well you think you have sealed that box, it's going to breathe. The only thing left to discuss is how slow it breathes. A rubber seal is a weather seal. It is not a hermetic seal. The air will slowly traverse across that rubber seal. It'll take a day to do it, but it's going to do it. Let me drop. So you're going to get slow breathing.
UHF for comment.
UHF recognized. You're going to get slow breathing of the air on the inside of the box versus the outside of the box. Therefore, you know the way Murphy's Law works. On a super hot day when the air inside the box is at maximum expansion, something's going to happen where you're going to get a torrential rain and a high wind blowing moisture into the cockpit, and you're going to get some moisture on the outside of the box. The box is going to be cooling. It's going to be sucking in condensing air as the temperature cools down, and it's therefore going to be sucking in the moisture. Therefore, you've got to accommodate that. The disc material replaced periodically is a possible solution that I'm mentioning. Mr. UHF, I think it was. Give us your full call letters and your name, sir, and then proceed with your comment. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick. The person who just signed in with an identifier, who was that? And please repeat that identification.
Dick, I think that's NY2HF.
Okay, NY2HF. Dennis, I think his name is. Go ahead, Dennis, if I get the name right.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. It's November Yankee 2, Hotel Foxtrot. There's a new product out on the market now. It's made by Rust-Oleum, and it's called Never Wet. And they take an iPhone, and they spray it with this stuff, and they throw it in water. And guess what? It keeps working. So that might be the key to marine use, and also use in like tropical conditions for radios. So you might want to Google that. It's called Never Wet. It's available in Home Depot, and it's a two-part spray.
It sounds like you've actually used this, Dennis. Roughly how expensive? How big a container? Should we buy more than one of them? How often do you think we should use it? Give us a few more words. Sounds like you've got experience with Never Wet. NY2, Hotel Foxtrot, K2RIW in the TechNet. I wonder if you heard what my question, Dennis, or should I repeat it? NY2HF, K2RIW, go ahead, Dennis.
Sorry, Dick, I was having a problem with Echolink. I had a drop out. By the way, the pause for Echolink is still keeping everybody out. I was trying for 20 minutes to try and get into this conversation. No, I haven't purchased it yet, but I have looked at it, and I was amazed at what it does. You put it on fabric, you can put it on all sorts of things, and no water goes through it. So it's also, it's non-conductive, so it's a really good thing for electronics. I don't know how big the aerosol cans are, but I understand there's two of them, and the only drawback with them seems to be that it leaves like a milky white sheen on it. So for radio, who cares? So back to you, Dick.
Hi, thank you, Dennis. Okay. What I think we should do once in a while, every third or fourth interruption, I guess we should wait for the four beeps, and then a few seconds beyond that, sounds like the Echolink at times builds up a long, what's the word for it, latency, long delay time, and therefore things don't get reset correctly. So as you can see, John, it is one hell of a challenge to take ordinary electronics that we own and mount it on a boat. There's one other ham. I'm trying to remember his call letters right now. When you go to his website, you see an awful lot of electronics that he has put on his boat. He's been there. He's done it. And why can't I think? K1. Is it the guy whose last name and his call letters are one and the same? Where he's using the he's really living in K2 land. but he's got to call letters with K1 because of the way he wants to make it look like the spelling of his last name. You guys probably know who I'm talking about.
K1NS?
Atkins. Is that the... is it... AK1NS? Is that it? I think that's it. Mr. Atkins. AK1NS. You go to AK1NS, go to his QRZ.com website. And he's the guy I think he is. You're going to see a whole lot of electronics installed on his motorcycle, his boat, and whatever. And so I'll bet you he's got an awful lot of the solutions. Good memory here, John. It's a tough environment. And as your questioner develops the solution for him, please tell him to come back and tell us what works and what doesn't work. Because this is the summertime. Lots of guys recreationally want to use their radios around seawater. And so we've all got repeater. Time out. We've all got this problem to some degree. So please have him come back and tell us what he discovers that works and doesn't work. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go to another one if you want to, John.
KC2QIQ with one more quick comment.
KC2WGB. Okay, I'm glad to recognize. You know, Dick, you know the kind of work I used to do. And sitting here listening to everybody with all of this information, it sounds like if he would hook this up in a Benzie box fashion, because 90% of the time, you're not on the boat. Well, maybe 80% of the time. If he could just have it plug in, pull it out, like a plug-in module, and take it with him home, I think that would be his best protection for that radio right now. He's gone through two, and maybe that would be an idea. And Glenn would know more about the Benzie box style. I don't know if that'll work on a boat, but I think it would. And then I have another comment on the saltwater.
I'm waiting another couple of seconds. Go right ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, Dave, AK1NS, and I have had a lot of conversations in this area. Dave loves kayaking and sailing. I like jet skiing and sailing. And one of the key radio choices that both of us have made is Baofeng, because the radios are cheap. And we keep it high and dry. You hit them with WD-40, do what you can. But the key thing is store it in a plastic bag when you're not using it and keep it high and dry. But here again, too, it's a cheap radio that if you're out in the water, something happens to it, it's not like you're losing your $300 or $400, Yaesu VX8R. And, for a $35 investment, it's a lot better than losing a $400 investment in case it could shock you.
Okay, consider the radio a disposable, a throwaway. Now, the word Fenzy box, give us a few words on that one. That's a new one to me. You probably lived with it for years. You assume everybody knows what it is. I don't. Is it something I can buy at the Home Depot? How expensive? How big? How many different sizes? Tell us about a Fenzy box. KC2WGB, K2RAW.
KC2WGB. Just leave a little delay there. Yeah, Fenzy with a B. They made them for car radios so that you could just unplug the car radio like it would be on a slide, and you just pull it out. I've never had one in my car, but I know people use that. I'm sure he could make something with quick disconnects to remove the radio and just carry it home with him and prevent all of that aggravation. Rather than worry about spraying it or building boxes, I think that would probably be his easiest way out.
KC2QAQ with a comment?
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, those removable type of brackets and boxes and things, they're a connector nightmare. The kind of problem that you have between vibration and salt infusion and everything on a boat, it's just the connectors will eat you alive. So everything from the antenna connections, I mean, it's really a last resort. You don't want to really do that if you don't have to. The other things, too, are just because the radio keeps on coming off the boat doesn't mean that it's not salt infected. So realistically, you do want to spray the WD-40 on it regardless, especially on the inside, where the PC boards and switches are and things, volume controls. You really want to kind of douse them pretty good with the WD-40, because as I said, even it coming on and off all the time, the salt just, it finds its way inside. KC2QIQ.
That's false, Craig. Pesky stuff. The Benzy box. Who sells it? How expensive? How many different sizes? John, give us a couple of words on Benzy box. Do they come small, medium, large, cheap, expensive, fancy latches, fancy ways of opening and closing? Some of the plastic boxes with rubber seal that I've seen in Home Depot and other stores like that, Lowe's, look to me like they got lots of volume inside, reasonably good, tough plastic, nice carrying handle, and looks like at first it could do a pretty good job of keeping an awful lot of the environment away from your electronics. Now, how you get access to the tuning knobs is another whole problem. Tuning knobs, input, output wiring, and so on. So, these Benzy boxes, how many different sizes, how many dollars? KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Dick, from what I remember, you could get them from anybody who installs car radios. They provide that. What they will do is take out your existing radio, and you buy a new radio. They will put the Benzy box, which mounts right in the dashboard. It comes in several sizes, and like Glenn said, there's a bunch of contacts in the back. They put a block on the back of the radio, and you just slide the radio in, and it makes the antenna connection, power connection, speaker connections all set up. But Glenn is right. I would definitely spray it with the WD-40, even if I was removing it from the boat, because a few hours at sea is it's a long time. But there was one other thing I wanted to mention about salt water, which we really never covered. Many hams that have their shacks in the basement with backup batteries, that's a confined space. And when you get salt water in there, you have chlorine generators, and that's deadly. So that's another thing to keep the batteries high enough so that by the time the water's at the battery level, you don't have it where you would be in there. Not that you should go in there at all, but you also have to be worried about that chlorine generation.
Now, I've run into a dissimilar metal problem. Even though I am, let me pick a number, 10 miles away from the water, I'm in northern Huntington. I'm in southern Huntington. Southern Huntington. Dick Fills is the actual name of the community. And I think I'm a healthy 10 miles from the Long Island Sound and 15 or 18 miles from the Great South Bay. So you would think I wouldn't get very much salt spray. Transco is a very high-quality company that makes high-performance microwave relays, TRANSCO. So I had a whole bunch of these Transco relays, type-end connector, single-pole, double-throw, mounted in the middle of my array of 16 Yagis as the zoom control. If you Google the word K2RAW, you'll eventually find this red QSL card, which shows you 16 Yagis on 432, 305 elements on 100-foot tower, with me standing in the middle of that 3,500-cubic-foot antenna. That antenna had three of these very high-quality Transco relays. Let me drop. Is that... somebody want to sign in? You're giving me a call, Letters. Who was that?
Jay, just wanted to pass along. The company that made Benzy boxes went out of business a long time ago, but there's a company called Zero that makes enclosures and slides for all kinds of electronic equipment on boats, and they've been around for like 30, 40 years.
Okay, you gave us that name very fast. You're going to have to give it to us. Spell it phonetically. So who is the replacement for Benzy boxes, Eric? KE2EJ? K2LAW?
This goes back to when I was like 16, 17, and 18 when I used to work in Freeport in the summer doing boat radars and that kind of stuff. There's a company called Seaworthy, S-E-A-W-O-R-T-H-Y, Seaworthy. And they still make all sorts of enclosures and slides and removable mounts for boat electronics.
Okay, so Seaworthy you think is the replacement. You're fairly sure that Benzy is no longer in business, is that what you're saying, Eric?
They went the way of the 8-track many, many years ago. They haven't been around in a long time.
Hey, John, you and I were born the same year, and we're living in the past. It doesn't exist. Okay, so these Transco relays were part of the switchable relays that gave me the zoom control on that phased array of 16 Yagis, 304 elements on 432. Allowed me to torque 480 miles, day in and day out, single sideband to a K4CAW down in Greensboro, North Carolina, which is 10 times beyond my radio horizon, so that was a real fun experiment. Anyhow, after 4 years, 4.5 years, Hurricane Gloria removed that whole array from the top of my tower for me, deposited it into the backyard, front yard, and I took it all apart and tried to take apart the relays. As I said, it was a real high-quality Transco relay, and I thought I was using medium good quality Type N connectors made by the M.P. Jones company, supplied by M.P. Jones. They looked like they were nickel-plated. I'm not sure if they were or not. Anyhow, every one of those connectors, no matter how tightly I put the channel lock pliers on them and dug into the metal, I could not remove one single one of all of those cables from all of those relays. In fact, what I did do one day was to split one of those nuts apart of the Type N connector by using a Dremel tool with the cutting, the ceramic cutting wheel, and I cut a great big notch across one of those nuts of the Type N connector right down through the threads that were on the Type N female of the Transco relay, and then stuck my screwdriver in there and tried to spread the nut to get it apart. The dissimilar metals there was such that those two were welded together, every one of them. So what looked like a medium-high quality Type N connector with nickel plating onto those Transco relays, my goodness, the dissimilar metal I ran into at the top of my 100-foot tower after four...
Repeater, time out.
As I was starting to say, the dissimilar metal problem I ran into on the top of my 100-foot tower, at least 10 miles away from any seawater, still I'm guessing the equivalent of salt spray got in there, and wow, are they frozen. And so I don't know whether or not I was able to remove any of those connectors. That whole project was quite a few years ago. I'll have to go to my junk box and retrieve those and see what condition I was able to leave them in. So dissimilar metals, salt water, boy, you got to be careful. Tough stuff. Back to you, John. KC2WGB. I hope you can give us a good solution as he finds them. K2LIW and the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very well. Good answers and some great questions. So that's about it from the mailbag. I think we should go over to Paul and see what interesting things he has from NASA for us. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
This is a good question.
Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, it's just a quick question. Did you have a chance to look at that 3 minutes of video that I had sent you, so we can discuss that after Paul?
Yes, I did, and I've got quite a few comments when we get to that later on, Wes. And unfortunately, it's not quite as clear as you and I would like it to be, and I'll describe what I think are the slight problems with that display. But it's an exciting-looking display. Paul WS2N, our space person, what's NASA doing? And I hope I didn't misunderstand you that you were signing in with a question. If you did have a question, you're allowed to pose it right now. WS2N, KQLIW in the TechNet.
This is WS2N. No, Dick, I didn't have a question. No, I was just checking in with a space science report, so that was it. Good net so far. Very interesting. A lot of waterproof topics here. I mentioned the Pegasus spacecraft last week. That thing took off from Vandenberg Airport and successfully put the interface region image spectrograph IRIS satellite into polar orbit about 400 miles up. And we were discussing how many stages it has. It has the capability of doing, well, they say five, but it's really four. And then you have you have on a satellite, you'll have another engine for doing a mid-course correction or something. So they say five. But in this case, it was three. It was a three-stage those regions between the surface and the corona, try to figure out how come the surface is 6,000 and the corona is a million degrees. A major old question. They're going to look into that. Can we drop it? I wanted to mention that. And also a correction from Field Day. We were talking about the price of the cost of the James Webb telescope, and I was giving you $18.5 billion, but that was the budget. That's the NASA budget, but the telescope price isn't really too far behind. It's $8.5 billion just for that telescope. I wanted to correct that. I wanted to mention anybody that goes over to the www.nasa.gov website. They have changed it in the last day or two. You go over there, I mean, you can tell right away the whole field, instead of that dark blue, blackish look, it's now it's got a bright aqua look. They've changed the look. They've changed a lot of the ways that you're going to get onto different pieces of information. So a little small learning curve, but they're going to be changing it over the next couple of few months too, little by little. One thing they didn't change, which I wish they would, they probably will, is to access their videos. You do need to, which I don't have on my tablet. Drop it. See, they're not going to be supporting it soon anyway. It doesn't really pay to put that in. My guess they will change all of that. I mean, there is other ways to get into looking at some of their videos anyway, but it's just normally on a regular computer. I'll click on a video and I'll be able to watch something, but on my tablet I can't do that. Some tablets you can. This one, I happen to have the Kindle Fire, and it didn't come loaded with the with Flash, Adobe Flash. So that's pretty much it. But you asked about the Kepler. As far as I know, Kepler is still in the wheels, the momentum wheels are still not working. Let me drop it. There's still information coming back. There's a lot of things that were loaded on that telescope that they didn't look at. In fact, at the beginning of June, they released another possible 500 candidates. I think they're up to 132 confirmed, and they've got like 3,000 in the waiting in the wings to try to figure out if they truly are planets or not. As far as I've read it, it's not doing any more work. It's in a temporary state. They call it a point rest state. They're using thrusters, and their thrusters push it in one way, and then they let the solar wind kind of like push it in the other way, and it rocks back and forth, and they're going to leave it there until somebody possibly comes up with a possible solution of how they could put Kepler back into operation. But they did have an extended mission. They wanted to go at least another 3 years from now. This is WS2N. Let me drop it. And I thought I'd bring up one physics topic that I actually read. I didn't read on the internet. I got out of a magazine. They're talking about something that we've talked about before, dark energy. And there's a new theory that's coming out that maybe dark energy itself doesn't exist. Well, Dick, you know, I've listened to your theory before. And I thought they were going to start talking about the multiverses, you know, pulling everything over the horizon. But it's another pretty plausible theory that they do have that they're going to be working on, stating that there's a void, possibly it'd be a void, and in our case, in our region of the universe, and that because of this void, it's giving us kind of like false readings of all the supernova that they're looking at. They're the way they detect the expansion of the universe by looking at these supernovas go off all over these different galaxies. And this theory claims that there's possible voids. In other words, when the universe expanded, it didn't expand as everybody would imagine, drop it. But it might have expanded, you know, like you blow up a balloon. Well, you blow up a balloon, a lot of times they come out round, but sometimes you blow it up and it'll come out like on one side, it'll come out first a little bit, and then the next thing you know, it comes out another angle, and then eventually it blows up. They think that the universe might have started that way. That's the way it looks today. And if that's the case, you might have big voids. More, in other words, more areas with less mass. And if you have less mass, you're going to have the light speed of the supernovas that we're looking at would be different. And the problem is it brings in the Copernicus, you know, theory that, you know, everybody, when we look out on the universe, no matter where you are in the universe, it looks the same. Well, this would actually show that they're going back. I mean, that maybe we are something a little special in our area. If we have a spherical void around us, things might be a little different. But you can read more about it if you. I think Dick, you get a Scientific American. You might want to read that. They have a lot of good articles in one magazine I read. That's pretty much it, Dick. We'll pass it back to you. I wonder if you saw that article. I mean, Neil's had a good, very good article about the Higgs boson. What went on there? This is WS2N Space Science Report. Let me drop it 1 second. Over. Anybody wants to comment on this topic or any other topic, you can reach me at spacenetreport@gmail.com. Dick, over to you. Any questions or whatever? I'll be here. Back to you, Dick.
Good copy, Paul. And I'm disappointed that Kepler hasn't yet gone back into operation, because it was doing such an excellent job of finding exoplanets, planets going around other stars. And I believe there are future missions being planned to carry that work on further. And the James Webb Infrared Telescope, which is under construction, and if you Google the word James Webb and go to the appropriate NASA site, you take a look at this beautiful craft where they've got a mock-up on the lawn, a full-size mock-up on the lawn in front of one of the buildings of the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. I think it is, but they got a full-size mock-up. And so, glad to hear it's only $8.5 billion, which turns out to be $24.28 for every man, woman, and child in the United States, spread over 10 years of its development. So it's around $2.43. for man, woman, and child. In my opinion, we're going to get our money's worth out of that 10 times over, as I see it. Paul, let me drop. Because this is a mirror many times larger than the Hubble Space Telescope, arguably the most productive piece of hardware that NASA has ever produced in unmanned vehicles is the Hubble Space Telescope. And now this James Webb Telescope is going to be in a more desirable location, with a hell of a lot bigger mirror, a lot more sensitivity at infrared frequencies. So it's going to be able to penetrate those dense clouds of galaxies that are forming and stars that are forming and so on. I guarantee we're going to see things that we've never expected to see when that thing goes into operation. The only thing that scares me about that is it's going to be at Lagrange Point, I think it's number 2, the Lagrange Point that is a million miles away from Earth, on the side of the Earth away from the Sun. Absolutely, positively, no updating of that can ever take place. Hubble remains so extremely operational, and it got better and better in sensitivity. Let me drop. because of all of those repair missions. Each repair mission gave Hubble a more and more sensitive camera with higher resolution and better electronics and so on. So it was slowly evolving and improving while it was in space. What a piece of hardware. And so Hubble has given us pictures. But the trouble with Hubble is it's given us pictures so beautiful, and some of the pictures they've added some phony color to. In other words, you take a picture with very high resolution of Jupiter, Saturn, or whatever, or a nebula, and you, in order to really see what's there, you turn up the contrast and you turn up the acutance, the chrominance. In other words, if it was a color television set and the amount of color it's got, you can turn that knob. And well, with these Hubble pictures, they've done that. And the net result is that whenever you go to an astronomy setup where somebody is pointing a good telescope at Saturn, Jupiter, Orion Nebula, or whatever, you come away very disappointed. Burned into your brain is that Hubble picture of that particular object. And when you see it at the eyepiece with a real human eye in the dark on a real telescope, it is so pale looking by comparison. The colors are nowhere near as intense. You end up very disappointed. You think you're looking at the wrong thing. You say, that's not Saturn. That's not Jupiter. That's not the Orion Nebula. You end up saying those things because it doesn't look like what you remember with the Hubble picture. So the space telescope people have been accused of creating a little bit of a hoax with those Hubble pictures because they've got expanded contrast and expanded chrominance. But so once you know that ahead of time, know that when somebody shows you a real view through a telescope, don't expect to see those vivid colors for about three reasons. One, they're not really there. And two, let me drop. A human eye does not have full color reproduction on a dim object. Your eye retina consists of rods and cones. The cones give you color perception, red, green, and blue cones. That's where the color is coming from. They give you a very sharp picture with color, but they are not very sensitive. Outside of your center high-resolution portion of your retina, outside of that section, is a bunch of rods. The rods have got extreme sensitivity by comparison, but they only see in black and white. They give you a monochrome, very sensitive picture. That's the reason why all cats are gray at night. That's the reason why when you look at the Pleiades, you have to look off to one side, because it's a fairly dim cluster, the so-called Pleiades, the Seven Sisters, is what it's called. There's really more than seven stars there. But that particular star cluster is not super bright. You look straight at it, and it sort of disappears. You look off to one side, what any astronomer will call averted vision, and you see it right away, because you're picking it up with the rods, and you see nothing but a black and white picture. You take your 35 millimeter camera in the old days, set it on a tripod, open up the lens for, oh, let me pick a number, 15 minutes, and let the sky sweep through the lens, and close the lens down and develop that picture, and you'll see stars of every single color of the rainbow. And you'll say to yourself, where do those colors come from? Well, those are the colors they really have, and your color film is telling you that. Your eye doesn't see it, because your eye, a dark adapted eye, is mostly using not scotopic vision, but not photopic vision, but scotopic vision. You're using those rods, and they see a black and white picture with high sensitivity. So there's a lot going on there. Now,
repeater, time out.
I think you were mentioning the July issue of Scientific American, Paul, and yes, I haven't got a chance to really go through that issue yet, but it's got a lot of good stuff in there. And Scientific American is one of my favorite books. And the problem is, it's like a person who collects National Geographic. The pictures are so pretty, you're afraid to throw them away, and your house gets filled up with year after year of National Geographics. Well, my house is filled up with Scientific Americans, same kind of a problem. I'm afraid to throw them away. Now, I want to show you guys something that's really striking to me. I'm going to show you two paragraphs that when this arrived a couple of days ago, it was a mind blower to me. What I'm reading is the latest issue of Research and Development magazine, R&D, technology and strategies for research and development is the subtitle. So R&D Magazine, the June 2013 issue, volume 55, number 3, the editorial page entitled Pie in the Sky by the managing editor, Lindsay Hock. Let me read you. The first paragraph is a bit of a mind blower. The second paragraph is a much bigger mind blower. And you guys are going to say, what in the world's going on? Let me drop.
Dick, that wasn't the issue. It's a different book.
Okay, yeah, it wasn't Scientific American. What was it you're talking about, Paul? Go ahead.
Scientific American. I used to get the monthly issues. I stopped that years ago. But this is the Scientific American. It's a special collector's edition that came out actually probably around a month ago. Extreme Physics, they call it. I mean, the whole book is dedicated to all physics topics. I think there's at least 16 different topics. Dick, back to you.
I knew I was seeing the articles you were talking about, and I mistakenly remembered it as the July issue. Yes, I have the Extreme Physics issue, which is now on the newsstand. And I seem to remember it sells for about $7. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Nah, that would be a bargain. This is $9.99 everywhere. Thank you, Dick.
I know when I picked it off the shelf and looked at the back of the book and found out what the price was, I knew it was a little bit pricey. As I started thumbing through it, I said, hey, that's good stuff. And so without hesitation, I bought it. I mean, I'm worth it. How often do we do that? Okay, so Extreme Physics on the newsstand right now, a special issue of Scientific American, but it's not your normal monthly issue. Okay, so as I was starting to say, this the June issue of R&D Magazine has the two paragraphs. The first paragraph is a little bit exciting, but the second paragraph I'm going to read to you is a mind blower. I completely forgot what I'm about to read, and here it is. During the 2012 Republican primaries, presidential candidate and former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, made a promise to establish a permanent base on the moon by 2020 if he was elected president. He's a firm believer in space exploration. He was seen during the campaign frequently mentioning his plans to promote space travel. During one debate, he even went so far as to say he would like to colonize the moon permanently and get to Mars as fast as possible, to set up reliable space stations. To win extra votes, he said he would consider bringing rival Mitt Romney on as chief advisor to his moon colony planning team. Let me drop. That was the first paragraph. Boy, I completely forgot about that one. But here's the mind blower. In March 2013, a Dutch startup company called Mars One announced a similar plan. The company hopes to send a select group of astronauts on a one-way trip to the Red Planet by 2023. The Mars goal, was based on establishing a permanent human presence on Mars. According to the company news release, if all goes as planned, Mars One will launch 4 astronauts on this one-way voyage in 2022, landing the team on the planet's surface in 2023, after which they would begin constructing the colony. Let me drop. The plan after this, every 2 years, 4 additional astronauts will arrive to build up the colony. Think now, this is all one way. These people are not coming back. And here's the part that's really a mind blower. As of May 7th, 2013, the Mars One program had over 78,000 people sign up for this one-way mission. Wow. The degree of difficulty of getting a human being with all of his life support systems and all of his food requirements to Mars, you guys have heard me say before, that is beyond monumental, beyond heroic. And so this one-way mission, they want to do that in the early 2020s, and 78,000 people have signed up for a one-way mission. Have you heard anything that way out there? Do you know what I mean, Paul? WS2N, is this a new one on you? K2LIW on the tech net?
Dick, I think Paul mentioned that about 3 months ago. Over to you.
Boy, am I short on memory. Paul, refresh our memory. Do you remember all of those details? 78,000 people that are willing to go on a one-way mission? And Mars, the thing that scares me about this is that Mars sounds exciting. Let me drop. But it is the coldest, driest, windiest desert that you and I can imagine in this solar system. It's 150 degrees below zero all the time. It's got winds that blow 200-300 miles an hour. It's got air pressure that's a small fraction of 1% of the air pressure on Earth. And it's the driest desert in the world with a little bit of water below the surface, a whole lot of rusty red stuff around, no real life that we've discovered so far. Yes, it's another planet. It's got no ionosphere, so you're going to be bathed in continuous solar wind, X-rays and whatever, ultraviolet. It's a hostile environment. To maintain a human being at 150 degrees below zero, you need a tremendous amount of continuous consumption of consumables to oxidize or whatever to make the temperature. Your body's got to be kept at 98 degrees Fahrenheit or you're not human. So 98 degrees Fahrenheit versus 150, you're maintaining a continuous 250 degree temperature differential across the insulation of that spacesuit that you're wearing 24/7. The amount of energy required to do that, where's it going to come from? Assuming you've got the food to eat and then you're manufacturing it. The degree of difficulty here is huge, and the benefit you get out of it ain't clear to me. Maybe I'm a little too negative on this one, Paul. WS2M, K2RIW, and the tech man.
Yeah, John's right. I did talk about this quite a while ago, but I've read things about it since. And the reason I stopped talking about it, I thought it was a bit of a... I started to think it was a bit of a hoax. Where this guy is... I don't know if he's a con artist or what the deal is. He's like playing general contract. He's just going to get all these people that they say SpaceX is the Dragon space involved with him. Then I'll start thinking that maybe this guy's serious. And then what led me to believe that is that he's going to pick all these people, and eventually he's going to get down to four, but he's going to whittle it down to a certain group, and then he's going to have a reality TV show, and how to pick these people in the world is going to vote for who they want. I don't know. Let me drop it. It started to sound like, maybe an evangelist type of guy who's trying to put the money together. That's why I read more about it. I mean, and start seeing some hardware and people, real people involved. He's got to get the launch vehicle and all this stuff together. Yeah, some kind of habitat module to transport people from. Yeah, I mean, you just not going to put four people in a Dragon spacecraft and leave them there for months on end as they go to. You're going to need a habitat module. You're going to sign up with Bigelow spacecraft. They're going to inflate a big module. I doubt it. So, I remember, in fact, Andy, WATCDL, he told me to bring it up. He says, Justin Bieber signed up with this thing, and the singer. I don't know. I'd rather just not take it too serious. But what I do take serious, though, let me drop it. The Russian program to send people, just your everyday people up, and they've been doing it for years, back in 2000 with Dennis Tito and all. He's still very active. These were private citizens, Mark Shuttleworth and a few others have gone and spent countless days, maybe 4 to 8 days, maybe up in, on the International Space Station. You've got Sarah Brightman going up within about a year or so. She's